Welcome to the TechCast. I'm producer Becca Refford. The TechCast is sponsored by Chariot Solutions, a full-stack application development consultancy committed to building high-quality software solutions. With expertise in Java 8, Scala, Clojure, Spring, iOS, Android, AngularJS, and other open-source technologies, we can bring the right blend of expertise and technology to bear for your organization. Visit us on the web at chariotsolutions.com. Chariot Solutions offers consulting, mentoring, and training in open source languages, platforms, and frameworks, such as JavaScript language fundamentals, testing, and build tools, Angular 1 and Angular 2, Scala, and Akka. We're offering a special for our podcast listeners on the first Angular 2 course we have to offer. Join us for the first beta of our Angular 2 training class on May 24th to 26th and save $100 on your ticket with the discount code of TechCast, all one word, lowercase. Today's podcast features Ken Rimple's interview with Samir Farooqi and Brian Clapper of Databricks, the creators of the Spark Big Data Engine. He asked them about what makes Spark so powerful, reviewing not only the traditional writing of RDDs in typical infrastructure, but how the more modern Spark context query APIs can let the Spark engine select an appropriate query strategy. We also talk about the popularity of Spark and what it takes to be a Spark developer. Now, on to the TechCast.
So Samir Farooqi and Brian Clapper, you guys are both from Databricks. Welcome to the Chariot TechCast.
Thank you.
And so just before we start, let's talk a little bit about what Databricks is. So Databricks is a company that produces the Spark Big Data Framework, right? And so like, what is it that they do? They have a product around it or what?
Well, so there are two things, really. It was founded by developers of Spark, the creators of Spark.
Right.
So Databricks pays, you know, the core developers to work on and improve Spark. So that's a good thing for enterprise adopters because somebody out there is actually making sure that this open source product is maintained, right? And enhanced and forward looking. But they have their own product as well. We have our own product, I should say. I recently joined. I'm still working on the pronouns. But we have a product that It's notebook-based in the same way that Jupyter is notebook-based,
okay.
But that's not the only thing that it provides. It does cluster management for you in the cloud and provides security for you so that you can tie this to, for instance, your own AWS-based infrastructure, and then this thing simplifies the job of granting people access to clusters, spinning up Spark clusters, running Spark jobs, loading Spark libraries, whether they be Python or Scala. It makes it very easy to do that. And then, you know, you can do development either within the notebooks, which we very frequently do, or you can even do development in IDE and upload your stuff, you know, and it will make sure the environment then makes sure that all that stuff is distributed out to the clusters. So it's a convenience mechanism to make it very, very easy, convenient, and manageable to work with Spark in the cloud.
Okay.
So before we say, go, Samir, did I get that right?
I think you nailed that. Yeah.
Verified. Yeah. So Samir, let's go with you. So before we get into anything else, can we talk about just at a high level what is Spark for the average enterprise, you know, server side developer? It's a big data system, but how would you describe it to them?
Yeah. So Spark is a open source big data processing engine. It's Apache licensed. Most of the source code is written in Scala. And what Spark provides for programmers is different perspectives on top of their data. So there is a SQL and DataFrames APIs. If you are used to like pandas in Python or DataFrames in R, very similar API in Spark. If you come from a relational database background, there's a SQL interface into the data as well. On top of those two fundamentals, there's also a machine learning library in Spark. There's a streaming engine in Spark, also a graph processing engine. And really the interesting thing about Spark is it provides developers a unified API essentially across SQL, data frame, streaming, machine learning, and graph processing. So you can write one application and intermix all of your code between those different processing paradigms.
And now, so the primary programming languages that are supported out of the box?
Scala, Python, and R, and some people count SQL.
Right.
Java as well.
Java as well, right. Mm-hmm. Although I should remember that, and I forget, because most of the people we talk to aren't using Java with it, but any of those four languages. The other thing that's important to mention about it is that it is in some sense a response to some of the problems that plagued Hadoop over the years, right? If you think about the way Hadoop MapReduce jobs work, if you want to chain several MapReduce jobs together, because you know one MapReduce job is pre-processing your data, the next one is doing some analysis. Between those two jobs, the data that you're processing gets persisted, typically to some sort of a distributed store like HDFS, right?
Yeah.
Well, the fact that you're re-persisting this data between each phase of your long chain of jobs tends to slow the jobs down. So one of the fundamental insights that the Spark developers had was there has to be a way to do this that we're not constantly going back to disk. So Spark is, in general, quite fast compared to Hadoop because it's optimized to keep as much data in memory as possible during processing to take advantage of you know the faster memory access and the location of the data you know within the processing engines. So it's also an optimized, like people think, well, it's like Hadoop, right? And it's in the same space, but it's not the same kind of engine at all. It does use Hadoop I/O libraries under the covers, which essentially means that if you're a Hadoop developer and you've got a bunch of data in HDFS or S3 or whatever,
it can read anything
Hadoop can read, but it's not doing Hadoop MapReduce jobs and it's not re-persisting to HDFS between every pass. So that's like a fundamental insight that led to the development of Spark, and it's still at the bottom line, I think of it as its first killer feature, not the only killer feature, but like the first killer feature is that it's all in memory.
Now, Spark actually isn't what was originally created as a product, right? It was basically a proof for a technology platform. Is that right? I thought it was.
What do you mean by proof?
So, meaning that it was the first piece of software written on a particular platform, right? I could be wrong about this, but
what's the platform?
I want to say Mesos.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So what was happening is at Berkeley, there were a bunch of people in the AMP lab, which is a kind of a lab at UC Berkeley. And the students were mainly systems programmers and systems researchers. And a lot of them were doing internships in companies like Cloudera or Facebook or Google. And, you know, like 6-7 years ago, one of the most interesting things was cluster architectures. And yeah, they basically invented Mesos first, and that's one of the projects that like Matteo was working on originally. And yeah, Mesos is just a cluster manager, so you can like run any application you want inside Mesos, and it just manages it on top of the hardware. I think, you know, back then, one of the students like asked Matteo, like, hey, okay, Mesos is kind of cool, but how do I use it? Can you show me a prototype application on top of Mesos so I can then figure out how to write my own apps on top of Mesos? And Matteo was like, all right, fine, yeah. He'd like code it up like Spark on the weekend, and he's like, okay, here's like a simple data processing application that kind of like, you know, does in-memory processing. And, you know, from that, like, really humble beginning, Spark actually just kind of blew up to now supersede Mesos even. And now it does not require Mesos as a cluster manager. You can run Spark on Mesos, but you can also run Spark on Yarn, which comes with a lot of Hadoop distributions. Or you can run Spark on Standalone, which is basically a special cluster manager that only runs Spark apps on top of it.
Gotcha. So RDDs. Okay, so we're talking a little bit of technology, right? An RDD is kind of like the basic unit of data, right?
Yeah.
In Spark?
Well, the way I describe an RDD when I'm teaching classes is, and this will make sense to a Scala or a Java person, maybe a little less so to a Python person, but think of a collection.
Right.
Think of the Java Collections API or the Scala Collections API. Or if you're a Python programmer, think of a list or a map or a set, a list or a dictionary or a set, right?
Mm-hmm.
These are collections, and we have various operations that we can perform on them. In Java 8, you know, you can do collection streams and you have maps and filters and things like that on them.
Right.
And you have all of those things and then more in the Scala Collections API. Right, now imagine that collection broken up into pieces, which we'll call, for the sake of argument, partitions,
mm-hmm.
right? And distributed out across a cluster of machines. So that now you're processing that collection. Instead of all in one place in one machine, you're processing it in parallel across a number of different machines. In essence, that's an RDD.
Okay.
It's a chunk of data. So
okay.
A good way to think about it is, how does one of these things get created? A very common case is, I have a file sitting over there in HDFS. I want to read that and process it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I were to do that in a single process, what might I do? I might suck that into a collection in memory. and then process it in that one process using the standard collection semantics. Right, I'm going to map over it and translate it, or I'm going to extract things out of it, or I'm going to drop things by running a filter operation on it, right, in memory. The problem is that that only works up until it doesn't work anymore because it doesn't fit into memory.
Right.
So now imagine that what you've said is, look, I still want to do that exact same processing, but it won't fit in this machine. But I do have this cluster out here, and I've got a bunch of stuff running in this cluster that are tied to this application. We have a name for that, but it's not relevant to this part of the discussion.
Right.
And what I tell those guys, those pieces of my application running out there in the cluster, is, look, you take block one of this HDFS file. You take block two of this HDFS file. You over there, you take block three. The guy I gave block one to, you also take block four. And this just kind of goes around until all the blocks in that file have been allocated somewhere across the cluster, right? And then, you know, you just kind of say go, and that processing that you would have done serially in memory if it had fit is now happening in parallel across multiple machines and within a machine across multiple threads, right? So what you've done is you've broken up that collection into pieces, into partitions, broken up in some natural manner based on where the data came from. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Hadoop, it's the natural break point is the size of the block, right? So that's what it is. You're doing distributed collection processing across a cluster of machines and groups of threads within those machines, because you can't do them all in your one process.
Right.
But it's still semantically, it's just like a collection.
Right.
So you're operating on what look like collections, functionally chaining different methods onto each other to get the answer.
In fact, functionally is exactly what it is, because RDDs follow the functional principle. They are immutable, like a good collection in Scala would be.
No side effects, return
of
value.
No side effects, right? And they have standard higher order functions attached to them, map, filter, you know, flat map, and many others, all of which tend to take lambdas, so it's a higher order function, right, for the functional programmers out there. It's a function that is parameterized by another function. So in fact, if you were to look at the Scala API for RDDs, if you're a Scala programmer, it's going to look awfully familiar.
It's going to look like set.
What's going to look like the collection API.
Right,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's going to look like the standard Scala collection API. And that's no accident because it's been modeled on that API.
Now, if you're programming in like Python, for example, how different is the Python API? Is it still just chained? Would it be then just chained methods?
No, yes. It looks the same.
The API
it looks
same.
Essentially the same.
On Java
Right. So for the biggest impedance mismatch then for a Python programmer is going to be something like this. Okay, so in Python, what's the standard way that you typically do a map or a filter? You use what's known as a list comprehension.
Right.
Or if you want it lazily, you want to do a generator expression, which looks exactly the same, except you use parens, right?
Right.
That level of integration with Python isn't there. What you're doing is the same thing you're doing in Scala or Java. So you have this RDD, which models this distributed collection, and instead of list comprehending over it with if statements for your filters, instead you're saying RDD.map and you're passing a lambda or a function into it, .filter and you're passing a lambda or a function into it, right? So it's a little bit different than the way we traditionally do things in a Python program, but it's not that big. I mean, if it's described in terms of here's what you do with a list comprehension, it's not that big a translation to make.
I should also point out, though, it's April 2016 right now, and even though RDDs were the original data abstraction on top of Spark, you know, and RDD stands for Resilient Distributed Dataset, in 2016, new users to Spark should probably not start with RDDs. They should start with learning the Data Frames API and the Data Sets API. Specifically, the Data Frames API is very user-friendly, and it's very similar to Python, Pandas, or Data Frames in R. And the main power you get when you use Data Frames or Data Sets is that your query that you write in Data Frames or SQL or Data Sets will go through a Catalyst optimizer, which will then generate code that will basically be a physical plan that will generate code that can do a bunch of intelligent optimizations that the RDD API doesn't have. For example, like one or two of those optimizations are, one thing is that like Catalyst will do partition pruning and column pruning. So for example, if you're reading from like Cassandra or JDBC and you say, in Spark, hey, give me a data frame from this table where the age of the users is over 21. If you do that with data frames or data sets, it will actually push the predicate into the database and tell Cassandra, or the relational database, or the Parquet file, give me back only the rows that match this filter and nothing else. But if you do it with the RDD API, it will actually read all of the data.
Scans it.
It will scan all of it first and then do the filter in memory in Spark. So it's far more efficient to go through the Catalyst optimizer to do those type of optimizations.
It's like a select statement going to the client versus putting the where clause in.
And in fact, that's actually, the select statement is actually the right way to think about it, because there are other optimizations that it does. Well, right. So the other common thing is, if you're writing a functional transform and you do a map and then you do a filter, a lot of times that's the wrong order.
Yeah, filter first, get only the data you want, and then map.
But the problem is nobody fixes that for you.
Right.
And that's also true in the RDD API. So if you get it wrong, you get it wrong, and it executes it the way you told it to execute it. Right. Now, if you do the same thing at the data frame API, what you're not actually giving it the code to execute. When I teach classes, I say, look.
You're giving a request.
Right. Well, essentially, you're building a query. That's the key part, right? So when I teach a class, I tell students, look, with the RDD API, you have to figure out what you're trying to accomplish, and then what you're coding is the how.
Right.
Right?
You're the execution plan.
Right. With data frames, what you're doing is you're trying to figure out what you want to accomplish,
the
and then you're doing the same thing you do with SQL. How do I write a query that does this? But if you think of an RDBMS, when you do a select statement, you are not telling the database, hey, use this index, do a full table scan because I know the table is small, and only query this. You're not telling it any of that stuff. You're giving it the query, and the database is figuring out what is the most optimal way to satisfy what this user wants. You're giving it the what. The database is figuring out the how. And the exact same thing happens with the data frame layer in Spark. You give it the what you want in a structured query kind of language.
Yeah.
It figures out under the covers through a series of optimizations what is the most efficient way to accomplish that job. And that may mean moving things around, moving the filter up front, consolidating filters, shoving stuff down into the data source.
Right, which is why databases were so popular for so long, is that they do the execution plans, they optimize. So you're getting to the point now where you're able to kind of request things in a functional style, but let it reorder things and let it do that.
And that's exactly
brilliant.
Right. It's exactly what's happening. And it gets better with every release.
Very cool. Okay. So do you think 2016 is the year of Spark really taking off? It feels like it. It seems like it's been growing, but it seems like everyone's talking about it this year. Would you say that? I mean,
I don't make tech predictions.
Yeah, well, let's not call it a prediction. Let's just say, in your experience, have you seen a lot more interest this year than you've had in prior years? I mean, it's still early.
I've been pretty deeply following Spark for about 2 years now.
Uh-huh.
2 years ago, when I joined Databricks, it was not clear what would happen in this big data space. But I think that, like, right now, it is pretty clear that Spark has become the de facto engine for big data processing, mainly because how simple it makes it.
Uh-huh.
Now, like, what will the next trend be for the next few years? I'm not really sure. I think that, like, what would be really cool, actually, is if, like, undergrad students, instead of learning Python Pandas, start learning Spark right away, because it actually works, it's just as easy, and it works perfectly fine on one machine, but they know that this is some software that, when they need it to, it will scale to hundreds of terabytes, petabyte level. So I think that if that does get accepted by the community, then I think it'd be really awesome. Its potential is a lot more than I think what we're even seeing right now.
And as another data point, and there's a plug coming, so I'm going to warn you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So as another data point, one thing I know, we've accelerated the Spark training that we're doing over the last 8 months, 9 months.
Uh-huh.
We do not have, we have a much, much higher demand for training than we can satisfy with the number of instructors we are able to field.
Right.
Okay. So I don't know, what does that measure? It certainly measures a high interest in Spark.
Correct.
I won't do trend analysis on that.
Right.
But there's a huge interest that it's hard to satisfy out there. So that to me indicates an enormous interest in using this technology. And now the plug. The plug is that if you or any of your listeners think you're really, really good at teaching Spark, or would like to be really, really good at teaching Spark.
I bought you a beer, didn't I?
Yeah. They should get in touch with us, because that there's there's demand out there,
yeah,
and we're looking for good people to help us satisfy that demand. You know, want to do some contract training? Come talk to us.
One last question then. So I know that there's the micro-batching process where you've got streams of data coming in, but realistically you're chunking it up into small micro-batches. So then, if I'm correct about this, these are the RDD pieces that get handled?
Yes.
And you'll hear some other big data stuff saying we're pure streaming. Is there a disadvantage to implementing it that way, or you think there's an advantage to do it the way you're doing it so you can hit more nodes versus like purely streaming?
Well, I'll say a thing or two for like a minute, and then I'll have Brian answer as well. But I mean, from our research at Databricks, I think something like 90 to 95% of streaming use cases can be satisfied with a batch interval of like half a second.
Okay.
Most people don't need to be doing streaming
so
at the millisecond.
Kind of thing, or?
Well, in Spark, basically you can go as low as about half a second.
Okay.
Whatever data comes in that half a second batch interval makes an RDD.
Right.
So you get like an RDD every half a second, and then you process that RDD with your exact same code that you would have used if you were doing batch processing on petabytes of data.
But it's semi-real time at that point. It's close
enough. Well, yeah,
enough,
you just like
maybe
copy and paste your transformations and actions and apply it to the D stream that's coming in
right
every batch interval. So it makes it really easy, and if you really have a use case where you have to operate on your data in like, I don't know, 10 milliseconds, then Spark Streaming is probably not your engine of choice. But we think that that is not the vast majority of streaming use cases. And the power of Spark Streaming is not just the fact that it can do stream analysis, but you can intermix your stream analysis with machine learning, graph processing, SQL queries, without having to learn a whole bunch of new engines. And that's a lot of cognitive overload on a programmer to intermix like seven different engines together. So I don't know. I think that the micro batch model works really well for like 90 to 95% of streaming use cases.
Well, and the other thing to consider is there are some other things that this can do. I mean, when you think about it, the fundamental unit of execution in Spark is the RDD,
mm-hmm,
right? So if you wanted to build a streaming engine that is a true on-demand stream engine, that would be hard to do without re-architecting parts of Spark.
Right.
On the other hand, you know, Samir's assertion is true. If 90 to 95% of the cases can be satisfied with a micro-batch architecture, in other words, you're okay with a half second, 500 milliseconds of latency, then it's beautiful because you get all of the benefits of Spark, and even more to the point, he mentioned earlier, everything is moving away from making programmers do RDD level stuff and more toward a data frame orientation, right?
Right?
So examples of this, the previous version, the original version of the machine learning library was all RDD based. The new version is all data frame based. The current version of the graph processing library is RDD based. There's a new library, Graph Frames, which Samir demonstrated today, which is all data frame based. In Spark 2.0, that you're gonna see the first examples of a data frame based streaming engine. Why is this important? Because what this means is that now all of those optimizations being done by the Catalyst Optimizer apply to graph processing, they apply to streaming, all of those things now get leveraged automatically. So, and the other final point to make is that like we sat down and talked to the guy who runs the streaming team many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you hear over and over again is that they'll say, look, we know this is not real time. We are optimizing throughput over latency. Okay, so you're gonna live with a little bit of latency, but the goal here is very high throughput.
Right.
If latency is your problem, there are other solutions to that. But throughput, in most cases, is the bigger problem.
Right.
So
right?
Spark Streaming can do at least a terabyte a second. There is a neuroscientist
wow
named Jeremy Freeman who works in a research lab on the East Coast that has like one of the most coolest use cases for Spark, where he basically takes images of zebra fish brains, and then what he does is he like zaps one of the neurons in the brains to kill it, and he watches how the neurons around that killed terminated neuron all react to recover. And he's basically using Spark Streaming to do his analysis, and I think he's collecting about 1 terabyte of data every hour
wow
of imagery data, so it can really handle a lot of throughput.
Right, gotcha. All right, well, Samir and Brian, thank you so much for talking to us today.
You're quite welcome.
All right.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you.
Check out our website for more content over the coming months. We'll announce it via our Twitter handle, @ChariotSolution. But if you want to browse, you can hit chariotsolutions.com/techcast for all of our podcasts, chariotsolutions.com/blog for our blog page, and chariotsolutions.com/screencast for all of our ETE podcasts. InfoQ is also hosting a page at infoq.com/ETE. Thanks again for listening to the TechCast, hosted by Ken Rimple, who is @krimple on Twitter, and Becca Refford, who is @bexrefford. Thanks for listening.